everyone. Welcome to History in Technicolor. I am David, the host of The History of England, and my partner in podcastery is...
Wolf.
At History in Technicolor, we discuss our interesting, exciting historical movies. Every episode, one of us will propose a historical movie we'll discuss and we'll mark in two dimensions. So we'll talk about how great a movie is it, and we'll talk about its historical accuracy. Then we'll post it on the History of England website and on Facebook, and you lot got to tell us whether we've done the right thing, what you think, and all the rest of it. So, this week, it's my turn, and I am proposing a movie called A Man for All Seasons. A Man for All Seasons was produced in 1966. It won six Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor. It won seven British Film Academy Awards. It was based on a play by Robert Bold. And it talked, the man for all seasons is Thomas More. So Thomas More was a philosopher. He was a famous humanist. He wrote Utopia. And he was also Chancellor of England during the realm of Henry VIII. So this is a sort of biopic, a slice of life thing about Thomas More, his relationship with Henry VIII, and his death by execution in 1536. So that's what it's about. So why am I proposing this film? Wolf, I can see the look of the question in your eyes. Why, for the love of God, are you proposing this film?
No, I actually understand completely why you're proposing it, but tell me what you think.
All right, I'm going to tell you anyway. So I saw it when I was a nipper, and I was spellbound with the sense of danger that I found, but also the sense of nobility of its core character, because this is, as I will explain, hagiography rather than history, or hagiography as well as history. Now, when I was a nipper, all I wanted to be doing is be outside playing footer, or imagining myself at Lord's whacking the Australian bowler over long on for six or whatever. So there's a thing. The fact that I was thinking about Thomas More was a bit of a success story.
When you say nipper, how old?
That's a good question, actually. I do not know.
Because it's quite different if you're like five and you're obsessed with Thomas More.
Yes.
And if you're like 12.
No, I wasn't five. I think 12 is pretty much when everything happened in my life.
Okay, yes.
So let's say 12. When we get onto film chats on the History of England, so we've done various film conversations about historical films on the History of England, and A Man for All Seasons is almost always at the top of the list alongside A Lion in Winter. Okay, it's, you know, they're jockeying for position. It's delightfully obscure. I've got two more reasons. The penultimate one is it's delightfully obscure. Here's a man who is killed for a principle that is completely alien to the modern world. But nonetheless, it's about a character who has created one of the greatest works of literature in the English language. Everybody knows the word utopia, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yep.
We talked about dystopia, utopia.
Did he invent the word?
Yes, he made the word. It means no place in Greek, I think. And he is a Catholic saint. He was beatified, if that's the right word, in 1968.
That's quite some time after,
though. That is quite some time after.
I thought he might have been made a saint a little bit sooner.
No, not at the time, because we just killed him. But the Catholic Church then came in and said, oh, actually, no, he's a saint, despite the fact that he burnt quite a few Protestants. But anyway, that's another story. And finally, because I loved the acting in it, and this will be an interesting point of debate, so that's why I'm proposing the movie. So now we get to talk about the film as a film, before we talk about historical accuracy later. And the historical accuracy thing, I warn you, I'll probably go for about 4 or 5 days.
Yes, that's okay.
So, you know, you might want to leave, actually, or get yourself a pillow and just, you know, whatever. So the film's a film.
Sleep like I did during the movie.
That gives us an idea then. So, right, how do you find it as a movie?
Okay, so first of all, to clarify, I was actually really interested to watch this, obviously having heard about it for a long time. It clearly is a classic, and there's a reason for that. I enjoyed it. I found it interesting.
Did you really enjoy it? Or are you just making that up? Did you actually find it really boring?
I enjoyed it in the sense that one watch was pleasant, enjoyable.
Right.
Would not watch again.
Right.
Purely because cinematically it has had nothing to offer.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it for the story, so I wanted to learn a little bit more about the history. I thought it was an interesting approach. Having Henry as a minor character is always going to be interesting because most people would be compelled to focus on Henry and then try and do a really good Thomas More in the background.
Yeah.
That was interesting.
It is quite interesting that we are obsessed with Henry VIII, and I don't quite understand why.
If you're trying to talk to kids about history, there's nothing to say about Thomas More. But you can almost instantly be like, did you know that we had a king who killed a bunch of his wives?
Yes,
and this is how they died. And kids are like, wow,
he's easier to sell than a great humanist, yeah.
Yeah, mostly his wives, to be honest. It's kind of how that...
Can I cry now, or should I do it? I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Anyway, sorry, you were saying, so as a film?
Purely as a film, it's not brash, which is fine. It's the film embodies Thomas More, and the way that he carries himself is really how the film carries itself, which is a compliment to the film, but that means that if you really aren't completely engaged with it, it's a bit slow.
Yeah, it's a bit slow.
I honestly really feel the age of the movie. I feel the period of time that it was made, which is never a criticism, really, but some films can really stand up years later and you think to yourself, wow, I almost can't believe that was made so long ago because it feels so fresh. This movie does not feel fresh.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right.
My criticism is not that the movie is like slow or what it chooses to focus on. It's... topic is interesting. It's clearly great that it focuses on Thomas, and I definitely didn't register that Henry was going to be in it so little when I started watching it. Wolseley to disappear like 10 minutes in.
Yeah, Orson Welles.
Especially because Orson Welles is on the... He sold as like the third biggest name in the film.
Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it?
But then he's good. But then he's gone.
That's why you don't have to compliment me when I crack great jokes. Just, move on.
Well, I feel like I should, and I'll continue to do so.
You're a very nice man.
I hope you know that I'm sincere. And I'm not laughing now, but that's only because of the awkwardness of being on the podcast. I'll laugh about it later on my way to
you're laughing inside.
Yes.
Yes.
I just think, if I'm truthfully honest, really feels like it's from a different era.
Is that because of the way it's shot, or because of the theme?
I think it's the way that it's shot. I think it's the costumes. I think it's the... colouring, the makeup, the approach to acting. It's, as we said in the last one, it's very theatrical. You can tell it's made for the stage, and that carries through into the movie. The sets aren't interesting to look at. The scenery isn't interesting to look at. There's no cinematography of really any type. The camera just watches the actors and they do their thing, which is one approach, which is fine. But it just means that it doesn't really lend itself to captivating you visually. You have to be completely captured by the performances. So it becomes a little bit harder, especially if you maybe are less engaged with that section of history, or maybe you don't completely connect with Thomas's ideological viewpoint.
How did you connect with Thomas then? Because I agree with you. You absolutely have to be engaged with the characters for it to be interesting, because there's nothing much else. There is some, but I agree with you. So how do you feel about Thomas?
It's obviously really frustrating because you watch him... condemn himself to death, and you watch him abandon his family, you watch him bring ruin upon his house, and you're just really begging him to just do what everyone else is telling him to do and not do it. And I understand, I really do understand why he would not bow to them, and I can respect it, but there's also a certain amount of me that's like, okay, so like everybody else has to suffer for you.
So there are two things I want to pick up. Okay, because I think that's a really interesting point. First of all, one of the reasons I realise that I like this film so much is that I believe theatre is a far superior art form to film.
Gulp.
Yeah. We are on a film podcast episode. I love film, dearly. Theatre requires you to engage. It requires audience participation.
Quick question. Do you think that you would prefer this on the stage?
I think I would like it equally well. There are some things that happen in this film that you couldn't do on the stage, but I accept your core point very much, actually. This is kind of like a play on a film. And so I like this because it is giving you no more than the bare essentials of background. Although it does do some, you have to engage with it. You're not distracted by the flummery, the is it perfectly represented? You have to engage with the story and the people. Well, that is my argument. It's why I quite like it. The second point about back when it was made, the story is about the nobility of what he does.
Yes.
The whole story is about the death for his conscience and his courage. So what we're saying is that maybe that attribute is no longer attractive. Are we more pragmatic than we were 40
years ago? So I think that is possible. I actually like that element of the story. I'm definitely interested by it. And I can ignore some of the clunky bits and the fact that really characterisation outside of Thomas and arguably Henry, there's very little. I did feel at times really like the female characters in particular were completely on the outskirts.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, wait, what's this being played to? Like, why is Thomas suddenly like shouting at his wife when she's really not done anything? Mm. Like, not only does she not have a voice in the movie and his family don't, they're just there to cause him like a distraction and they're like his maybe one out. So he does have to like consider them. But it's always, how does Thomas think about them? Not like, what do they do? And at the end of the movie, we have no idea what happens to them. I don't really know, like, what...
It's a film about Thomas and everybody else around
like
him.
Like, something terrific. Terrible could happen to them. Yeah. Or they might... Something great might happen and that they live on and stuff. But the movie doesn't care. It doesn't want to tell us anything about that. And I just still think that even in, like, the mid-60s, that's still outdated.
With his wife, I think that is partly because that's what the relationship with his wife was. And that's one of the criticisms I would have of when we get to history a bit. Well, do it now. Biographers always end up liking Thomas More because he's kind of... You know, he's the Archbishop of Banterbury, actually. He's a bit of a kidder. He makes jokes. He, you know, larks about. And he has a very famous reputation of being very advanced in his attitude to women for the 16th century.
Okay.
Because his daughter Meg, who he has a very close relationship with, he gives a proper education to all his children, including his girls. He doesn't make any distinction. And that's very unusual in the 16th century. And his attitudes towards education were really pretty revolutionary. His relationship with his wife is always seen as a bit jokey and, you know, he talks down to her a bit, but, you know, it's all a bit kiddy. Actually, his relationship with his wife is hideous. So his previous wife, Jane, this is his second wife in the film, at one stage, he gives her a bunch of fake jewellery, watches her glory in the fact that he's given her this jewellery, and then reveals to everybody that it's fake and laughs at her credulity.
Classic.
Now, that's not...
We've all accidentally done it.
You know, and to me, this character of Thomas that we have historically, one that is sainted, is much more flawed than actually he is presented to as in the film, where I think the film is trying to present him as a very noble, you know, very forward-thinking, very principled character.
Just slightly in terms of history, can you just explain to me what the Lord Chancellor of the Realm's role was?
It's a broadly legal one. It's the head of the legal system, essentially, as Chancellor.
He does accept the title, though, doesn't he?
He does.
Because a lot of the time I kept being like, I feel like a lot of this is happening because you still don't know how to make up your mind and you accept it and then you try and refuse the title. You try not to fulfil the role of your...
It's a fascinating conversation because the way he is viewed in history has changed a lot, I think, and you're absolutely nailing...
Which I'm looking forward to.
Should we finish off the movie?
Yeah, all I wanted to say about the film is that what I'm saying about like the way the film treats its female characters, I'm happy to ignore. I'm not looking for how women were treated at that time. Obviously, I'm not looking for it to be entirely inaccurate, but... They can be given a voice, and they are to some extent, but like you're already saying to me that Meg is far more important than the film bothers to show me.
Right.
So if it's happy to put Henry to the side, the movie's pretty bold. It's already got a new approach. Like, it could build that family unit a little bit more. They're really just background pieces. They have no significance. And I just think that this is all kind of building towards it being... not particularly successful on a cinematic level.
Right.
It doesn't, and obviously from the time and stuff, and I'm not looking for lavish, but as you can tell when we talked about Amadeus, a load of the enjoyment we're getting from that movie is the scenery, the dress, everything. When I watch this, none of that draws me in, and maybe that's because it's really old, but I feel like it all looks quite dated.
Yeah.
I feel like it's sort of almost minimalist approach.
It is. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that. I happen to like that and don't find that a problem. But I agree that it's a quite theatrical. The other thing I think works very well in the film, but I suspect you don't, is the acting. So for me, I mean, the cast is astounding. You've got, I wrote them down here, Susanna York as Meg, Paul Scofield as Thomas More, Colin Blakely as Matthew, Robert Shaw is the perfect Henry VIII. Robert Shaw is... The perfect, should I say that one more time? Robert Shaw is the perfect Henry VIII. He has him nailed. John Hurt as Richard Rich is just brilliant. You see his character decline, the desperation between his ambition and his desire to do the right thing and be connected with the person he admires and his failure to do so. And the way that's then represented in the clothes he wears. And I mean, I think he acts it beautifully. Robert Shaw It's a lovely bit. They come up in the boat and they arrive at Thomas's house, supposedly at Chelsea. And actually, although we're talking about the lack of cinematic quality to it, everything that is there is beautifully done. The fact that they could row up the river, that they land on a muddy bank in front of the house, is beautiful. I feel as though you are there in Tudor England, because that's exactly how it would be. Henry jumps off the boat. He's got all his gaudily covered courtiers in the background. He jumps in the mud and he's stuck, and his feet go in the mud and his nice golden shoes, and he stops. And everybody looks at him and wonders what to do. Then he decides he's going to make a joke of it, and he laughs outroariously. Everybody laughs with him and they all jump into the mud after him. It is a moment that is absolutely how it would have been. And Henry dominates the film, even though he is not there, or I think he does. You never forget him. You've only got one scene, but the way he treats Thomas defines everybody else then moves around that figure and that discussion with Thomas, that this is the divorce, this is what I have, that I must have it, that you are blocking me. And even though you never see him again...
Well, you see him once more.
Yeah, you see him once more, don't you? But he's not as though you're not having contretemps between Henry and Thomas, because you don't need to.
And I do agree, although they show him that second time, and they show him missing Thomas, and they show him having guilt. They try and convey all of this in a little moment, and then they never go back to it. And I'm like, wait, what are you saying? Now I need to know. Before, I wouldn't have worried. I'd assume he didn't care, but you're trying to show me that he cares, but you also don't really want to show me how he feels about all of this.
Because that is quintessential. That is absolutely Henry VIII.
Okay.
Here is a man who kills almost all of his friends. So he is a man entirely capable of thinking, oh, it's a shame Thomas isn't here. You killed him, sir. That is the kind of guy you're talking about here.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, I love the actors, but I can see that it is very character actor, is it?
I'm pretty captivated by the actors. It's really that I just feel like the dressing of everything around it, if I watched it on the stage, it would be just as good. I basically feel that the movie adds nothing.
Yeah, I don't go quite as far as you do. I do think there is some stuff. The boat scenes, as I say, are very good. I think actually Thomas' house is very good. So I think there is some colour there.
Lawrence of Arabia has made, what, a couple of years from this?
Yeah.
So it's almost the same time. It must only be a couple of years off. And that movie screams cinema. In every single shot of that movie, obviously their approach is to be a little bit quieter, maybe more in line with Thomas and focus on what he's saying. I just feel like it's not really using the medium in the best way that it can.
Okay, great.
Obviously, I know, I just have some reservations about it.
I understand, and I certainly agree that
it didn't click.
It's mainly theory. So anything else that we should talk about? One of the things I quite like about the film is that there is some humour. And there's a lovely line, Richard, it profits a man nothing to give his soul for the whole world, but for Wales. Now, I've often thought, you know, if I was Welsh, I'd object to that line, because, of course, Wales is far more important than the whole world. But, you know, there are some good lines in there. Actually, that line is historical.
Do we really think anybody, like, at that moment in their life, is that witty to be like, gonna get you? Oh, boy, history's gonna remember me.
Well, that is the thing about Thomas More. You are talking about a very, very intelligent man. He is capable of having delivered those lines.
Well, it's very good. I'm impressed if he did that.
Indeed.
Just before his death.
The big denouement, the trial, I thought actually that could have been done better, because what actually happens in the trials, there are 5 charges against Thomas, not just the one, and he destroys them on 4 of them. So they have to say, I'm sorry, yes, you're absolutely right. These charges that we have made cannot stand, because he's a brilliant lawyer. And you don't get that. It would have complicated the story, I guess, is why they decided not to do it.
He's so confident. He's like, there's no way they can kill me. I know exactly what I'm doing. And then one guy turns up and he's like, oh, great. It's that wimp from the beginning of the movie. And this guy's like, lies once. And he's like, no, you never said that. And then he's like, oh, great, I'm done. And I'm like, I'm just like...
A little bit naive.
Obviously, I think what they're trying to show you is that he was defeated by illegitimate means. He was not outsmarted, really. It was just people cheated. And also, the movie does not give me the impression of the general public. The movie, it just feels quite narrow in its focus. Yeah. I don't really get a lot of the time, the place, the other historical events happening, and how people view Thomas. It would be really interesting to know if the general public at that time really did not want him to die.
Well, the general public at the time, the king was close to a godlike figure. You know, the king is about to take England away from a 1,000-year allegiance to the Pope. And broadly speaking, this is the Pilgrimage of Grace, but broadly speaking, England will go, you're changing our religion, you're changing this allegiance that we've been told for hundreds of years is absolutely essential. All right then, King. You know, essentially, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, there'll be Catholics jumping up and down in fury all around, but that's what happened. So if the king says Thomas has got to die, most English would think Thomas must die. There's, you know, there's no playing to the gallery in the way that... Rich actually, interesting enough, he's probably caught out more than just cheating. So the story is, you're absolutely right, in the film, the way it's presented is that Richard Rich is this weak man who is suborned by the evil Thomas Cromwell into lying in court, perjuring himself and therefore condemning More to death. It's probably not what happened. It's just as likely that what Rich does is he tricks Thomas into a conversation about legal cases, so where you are allowed to stand outside the law and put cases that would be illegal normally. What Rich does is put some cases to him. What would it be? What would the legal position be if Parliament was to make Henry head of the church? And More says, he's understanding the normal rules don't apply because that's what the way it works. In that situation, Parliament would not have the right to make Henry the head of the church because the church is itself entire and indivisible and Henry has no
authority. So do you think he got outsmarted?
So he got outsmarted
by Richard. But the movie doesn't really show that, does it?
Because the movie's job is hagiography.
Okay.
You know, it's creating a saint in Thomas More. And it wants... The other flaw in the movie, historically, is that... it kind of presents Thomas as dying for individual right of individual conscience, that this is a modern theme. A man must be able to decide what his conscience believes. So there are some lines in it, because what matters is that I believe it. That's what he says. In matters of conscience, the loyal subject is more bounden to be loyal to his conscience than any other thing. This isn't what Thomas More died for. That's what the film says he dies for, the right of the man to make his own decision. Thomas More died for the right of the Catholic Church to decide what you should think.
Okay.
He died for an extremely esoteric thing, which is the church is supreme in its own area of competence, and that the king has no right to intervene in that area. King can decide what he likes about succession and all the rest of it. That's up to him. But essentially, the Catholic Church is indivisible across Christendom. One bit of it, i.e. England, cannot decide to secede. That's what he dies for. But that's something that we just think, oh, you know, why would he die for that? And so what the film does is turn it into a matter of individual liberty of conscience, because that's a theme we would understand. But okay. Clearly even that, you're not that impressed with anyway.
No, but I definitely find it interesting that that's their goal and that they're going to... converted, because actually some of the stuff that you're telling me sounds really exciting.
Mm.
I'd happily watch right. that, but they choose to not include that.
But I mean, that comes back to the point we were talking about earlier about the way that Thomas More's reputation has changed over time, because Thomas is he's a genius, and he's a very attractive genius. He's witty. His criticisms of the church are very sharp, are very much about you must reform, do a better job, you're too rich, you're not thinking enough about the people. His views on education are very progressive. He's a very witty, thoughtful, humane kind of man. He writes these fantastic works. The Utopia is one we've all heard of, but his output is amazing through his life. So I did warn you might have to get yourself a pillow. The way he is presented has been presented in history as a kind of Protestant before the Protestant Reformation, although he absolutely wasn't. But he's interested in education. He's interested in freedom of thought. He's a very fair man. You know, he's out of his time. This is an outstanding man. And that's the way he's been perceived for much of his history. But there are some things against that which don't come out in this film at all. So he burns heretics. He pursues heretics, Protestants, essentially. He even stands accused of having beaten them himself in his garden, but I think that's probably not true. But that's problematic. His attitude to his wife, as I've related, is really not as attractive as his humour has been presented.
Especially for a saint.
Especially for a saint. But I think it's because of his martyrdom.
Yes.
Because he does die for his faith. You know, there's no two ways about it. And for that, I think that is why he's made a saint. But I think what I'm saying is that these days we tend to see Thomas More as a much more complex figure. One more thing on that is that I think you were saying about this thing about being Chancellor. Thomas More presents himself as a disinterested political figure. He writes letters to his daughter Meg which say, I'm unwilling to be Chancellor, but it's my duty to do it, so I will do it. And the story is that Henry sells him short. Henry agrees, I won't involve you in the divorce, and then he cheats, kills him. It's very dicey. Why did he become Chancellor? He would argue it's because it is the duty of the intellectual man, that's part of humanism's creed, that you need to help the prince. It's his duty to do it. But it's a bit of a thin argument. You know, if you don't like politics, if you don't want to make these compromises, don't go into politics.
Do you also think that Thomas would actually have been able to do some good?
But he does that, actually, to a degree, interesting enough, that he only resigns when you get submission of the clergy. It's quite clear a year before that that Henry's going to make the divorce happen. He stays around for another year, largely because he wants to stamp down as hard as he can on heresy. Also, this story about the fact that Henry VIII sells him out, that's in that scene with Henry VIII. It's all about Henry saying, OK, I'll leave you out of it, Thomas. Fine. And the deal is that Henry will leave Thomas out of it and Thomas More will not make any pronouncements about the marriage. Thomas More does live up to that, but he writes reams of books after he stops being Chancellor that undermine the legal case for the divorce. So it's not even true to say that Henry sells Thomas More.
Do you think that his fate was already sealed prior to him writing those books? Or do you think that he provided more evidence against himself by doing it?
Possible he was still being killed because he would have been asked to make the oath like everybody else. But the point is that he remains in the public eye through his writing.
Yeah.
And he remains a public opponent. And it becomes important for Henry to either get Thomas on board and win a great propaganda victory or put him out of his misery.
I think this is definitely one of my biggest struggles. Like, throughout the whole movie, I'm never really truly on his side because I don't agree with his viewpoint, per se.
Right.
But also because, it doesn't really ever feel like he's defending something greater.
Yeah.
He believes that he is.
Yeah.
But especially because he keeps talking about himself as an individual. He's like, oh, I'm sorry if everyone in my family dies. As long as I go to heaven, this is all that matters. And the confusion of him accepting the role and then giving it up and then losing all the... And that causes problems for his family. Same. In the finale, when he talks to the executioner, am I correct that he forgives the executioner? And it looks like the executioner doesn't even want to do it. I got this impression that there was in this coda where was seemingly this executioner represents the people, and that maybe there's this feeling that they don't really want.
Well, I think they're selling a message, aren't they? That Henry VIII and tyranny, that he is trapped. Thomas Cromwell is drawn as a very negative character. He's all about power and evil. Is not not about transformation of the state. And Thomas Cromwell is a much more positive character in my view. And I think the implication in the film is that Thomas More is the victim of tyranny. And that's why I think you're right. The executioner is doing it against his will. There is a very slight suggestion, historically, in the final sentence that More says. He talks about something about maybe we will all meet together in the kingdom of heaven or something along those lines. And there's an act of forgiveness in that, which is part of the greatness of the man. But there is also a suggestion that maybe he's come to realise that different religious opinions are here to stay and there's some acceptance. But that's reading a lot into it. Anyway, we should probably conclude. We've talked about all the inaccuracies. In most other ways, it's incredibly accurate and beautifully done.
So that's what I was going to say. Do you think that it presents a standard interpretation of history?
I mean, I know that you have this thing about makeup, but by and large, what they wear is beautifully done. I think they make a lot of Hampton Court and the way the court works. I think the way they draw the relationship between courtiers and the king is a thing of beauty. The characters tend to be cardboard cutout. Nonetheless, historically speaking, there's a perfect justification for presenting the characters in that way. The train of events, I mean, there's a tiny inaccuracies, but nothing...
And nothing about this at the time would have made audiences think that that was a little bit unusual. This is completely how they knew the story.
Yes. I mean, in the 1960s, Henry VIII was still, by and large, a positive figure. You know, now he's in the orthodoxy is that Henry VIII is a terrible, terrible figure, personally and very negatively viewed. In the 1960s, he was much more viewed as the saviour, the guy who bought Protestantism, and isn't Protestantism a great thing? But the way he was presented, is incredibly radical.
Okay.
So we're going to mark it. Oh dear, this is going to be nasty. So you're going to mark it as a film.
Okay, you mark it what I think.
So I'm going to put it down as a 7 because I could watch that film as many times as you cared to show it to me, but I can accept the criticism that it's very theatrical, and maybe the reason I love it so much is partly because I love theatre so much.
The only thing I'll say is if you genuinely love the film, if you think that it is perfect in every way, do not rate it down.
No, because I don't think it's perfect in every way. I love the film, but it's possible to love
a film.
I was going
to say 6.
Yeah, okay, well, I would have thought that's
because I think
generous.
It's just because I think it's pretty good, but I'm just not really engaged by it.
Yeah. And then historical accuracy. The things that we've talked a lot about, I've warbled on about because I happen to be very interested by it. The truth is that the vast proportion of the film is very accurate, but the inaccuracy is very important. You see what I mean?
Yes.
That the fact that he's presented as dying for liberty of conscience, fundamentally wrong.
Okay.
So I don't know how to mark.
Because that's what the whole film is based on.
I would put it as an 8 for historical accuracy, in recognition of the fact that most of what you see is beautifully done, I think, in terms of accuracy.
I'll agree, because I actually couldn't even tell there was historical inaccuracies in it.
Yeah.
It was really that I just didn't feel like it was bought to the cinema screen in a particularly interesting way.
Okay, so we'll go 6 and 8. As per normal then, let me just take a couple of moments out before we finish this episode to talk about the last episode, Amadeus, and the discussion on Facebook, which, as always, was great. I love it. Amadeus certainly passed the test. The highest love it rating so far, 65% of you saying you loved it, even more than Master and Commander, which is, of course, extraordinary, if not actionable. There was, though, just a smidgen of Marmite in that there was a deep division. Some of you who really, really hated it. The Wolfie thing came up, and I have some sympathy. My parents back in the day almost choked to death in their outrage at Wolfie. So, fair dues. Andrew made the excellent and very well argued point that Amadeus, in being based on a basically fictional story, gave us no more insight into Mozart's motivation and character. It led to a discussion about historical accuracy in film, which will be a hardy perennial, I think, and I rather found myself changing my view of historical filmmaking and indeed novelists, agreeing with another of Andrew's points that, given Mozart's extraordinary story, why couldn't they have made a brilliant movie that was reasonably accurate, with allowance made only for dramatic requirements? Jennifer then made the point that maybe we should simply be excluding the film from the historical category, that Mozart was a vehicle for the theme of genius. Team Coxon from Australia was carried away by the Whigs, a fair point, while everyone agreed that music was the real winner of the movie. And look, Luke managed to persuade his son to watch the movie with only a couple of turns of the thumbscrews, so we're all winners. And then John came out with a superb Mozart joke, and there aren't too many of those around. Rowena immediately declared she'd be pinching it, and therefore so will I. So, according to John, a week or two after Mozart died, strange sounds started coming up from the grave. The mayor came along to have a listen, and he says that as far as he can make it out, it's Lacrimosa playing backwards, which is odd. While this goes on, sometime later, Eine kleine Nacht music starts coming out from the pit, also backwards. Nobody can figure out what's going on. At which point, Salieri speaks up and says, "Ah, it's okay, he's just decomposing." Quality, John. That is quality. Wolf and I will be back, but we will be back not in 2 weeks' time as normal, but in 3 weeks' time. Sorry about that. But we'll be back with a 1968 film called Charge of the Light Brigade. By the way, you might like to know that if you go to the website, thehistoryofengland.co.uk, there's usually some extra information. And the chart that we're building after every episode with your scores, our history and Technicolor ratings, and the ratings of websites like Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic, and so on. So go and have a look. Anyway, now, back in time to A Man for All Seasons. Great. Thank you very much, Wolf. So that's goodbye from Wolf and I, and I hope you enjoyed the debate. And we'll be putting up it on the website and on Facebook. So go along, tell us what you think, especially since I know so many of you love the movie. And yeah,
wish me luck, David.
Indeed. Bye-bye. Are you not entertained?